Anybody know anybody that's difficult? Are you difficult? We're going to talk about dealing with difficult people tonight. I think it would be appropriate for me to say a few comments about last evening in the lesson and a comment that was made at the end of the lesson. And what I want to clarify is that I didn't ever say Jesus was clinically depressed. Jesus did suffer emotions like all the rest of us. To deny that would be to deny his humanity. In Hebrews, the fourth chapter in verse 15, it tells us he suffered all things like we do, and that being made in likeness of man, that he suffered just like we do, and he had experiences just like we do. When I look at the emotions of Jesus, I see that he emptied himself of his glory. He came down to this earth, took on the form of a man. And that is that as he embodied, as deity embraced humanity, he also embraced all the emotions that go with humanity. Some of those would be identified such as his attributes of love that are demonstrated throughout the New Testament. We see that he was a man that could cry as he wept at the death of Lazarus in John 11:35. We also see that he could be angry as he threw over the money changers' tables and drove them out of the temple with a whip. And that would be Matthew 21:12. He was moved with compassion on more than one occasion, such as in Mark 1:41 and Matthew 9:36. And then ultimately we see him as he sweats in agony, as it were, drops of blood he felt in the garden. That's a rare form of a disorder that is called hematidrosis, and that would be demonstrated by the sweat as it was drops of blood, again demonstrating his humanity. He said, "If it be thy will, let this cup pass from me," in Matthew 26:39. And there, what we see is the struggle he was going through as he realized what he was about to face and the conflict that was there. And yet, in all of this, Jesus did no sin. So what we see is he's also identified in prophecy as a man of sorrow and acquainted with grief. Jesus had emotions just like the rest of us do. He was tempted in all points like as we, yet without sin, according to Hebrews 4:15. From all of those passages and others, I draw the conclusion that Jesus felt like we feel, though he realized when it was time to call it short and not get engaged in sin. So Jesus had emotions, and those emotions would take the whole range. He could be weary. And so in John the fourth chapter, we see him with the woman at the well. He's weary and he stops to rest, and his disciples go on into town. So we see some things about the emotion and the humanity of Jesus. And that was what I was referencing last night, that he had bouts where he was very exuberant, and he had times that just like us, that he had some days that he wasn't as bubbly as he was on other days. And so he experienced those things just as we do. And because he did that, because he was going through all the things we go through, he is able to understand the feeling of our issues, to know what it's like to be human. Because he did that and he overcame whatever was going on with him, then he is perfected. He's our high priest forevermore, according to Hebrews, the fourth chapter. So that's about all I'm going to say about that, because we have some other things to cover tonight. But I do want to respond to yesterday. Now, in our lesson tonight, we're going to be talking about dealing with difficult people. And I'm going to go through several verses at the beginning here and cite those. I'm not going to read each one of those, but I will cite those and a few clippets from those. And then I want to talk about maybe some very application terms on how to deal with difficult people. All of us have people in our life that can be that can create grief for us and cause us to have a little trouble in understanding and getting along and avoiding conflict. So in the first place, I would suggest that there are a medley of verses that deal with some guiding principles of how to deal with people. And we learn how Jesus dealt with people. He says, or we find, that there is a time to speak and a time to be silent. So as we deal with difficult people, sometimes we just need to be quiet. We don't need to say too much. There's a time to speak. There's a time to be silent. But we know that when it's time to defend the gospel, that that's a time to speak. So that Paul talked about being set for the defense of the gospel. Defending the gospel is an aggressive move. And that's what Christians need to be ready to do, to be set for the defense of the gospel. James talks about wisdom in James, the first and second chapters. And he talks about wisdom. And if anyone lacks wisdom, let him ask of God. But then in chapter 2, he talks about the tongue. And that's a whole lesson in itself about guarding our tongue, what we say, how we react to things. That's a guiding principle. And then in Colossians 4 and verse 6, there Paul talks about that we need to let our speech be not a lot of talking, but it needs to be seasoned with salt, that you may know how to answer every man. In other words, that we need to think about our answers, think about our responses, and not just pop off the top of our head or come up with something that we really haven't thought out. We need to be careful what we say, and that we guard our tongue and guard our heart with all diligence. In Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 2, the writer there in the wisdom literature says, "Therefore, let your words be few." And that is right after he says, "A fool is known by a multitude of his words." So those would be some guiding principles here. In the second place here, we find in Romans 12 and verse 18, "As much as in you lies, be at peace with all men." Now this gets at the Christian's attitude and how we follow the fruit of the Spirit, and that what we're doing is we're not going around trying to stir up trouble or trying to antagonize people, but instead what we're doing is we are speaking the truth and trying to live in peace with all people. In other words, going out of our way not to be antagonistic. In Matthew 10 and verse 16, Jesus talked with his disciples, and he told them that they needed to be as wise as serpents and harmless as doves. And there he's talking about attitude as we approach people. And this is, again, another guiding principle, and we need to ask the question that the disciples asked when Jesus talked about who would betray him. The one that was betraying was at the table, and they each said, "Lord, is it I? Lord, is it I?" And I think that's what we need to ask. I was told a long time ago that if something happens and we find ourselves in conflict, first thing we need to do is just make note of that. If it happens twice in pretty close sequence, we need to say, am I doing something I shouldn't be doing? And if it happens three times, then we need to back off and to do some soul evaluation when things are going wrong, like things just get worse and worse and worse. I can't seem to say anything right. And that's when we need to back off and think about our words and think about our approach and pray about that and study our Bible on that so that we don't do more harm by continuing when we see that things are heading in the wrong direction. Be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. And then Colossians, as we talked about, we need to know how to answer every man. In the next place, I would suggest in our medley of scriptures that we see Jesus in his life dealing with a variety of people. Some of these are narcissistic. Some of these are certainly wrong motive. Some are very sincere. And I want you to notice that Jesus, the perfect example, did not have what we would call a 100% track record in changing everybody. So neither should we expect that. There will be times that we talk to people and they have a receptive heart and they're willing to listen. There'll be other times that the Word of God and our manner of life will harden people to that and will create conflict, and that will make for difficult situations. So Jesus also talked about, or we find in Luke the 11th chapter, verse 53 and 54, that the Pharisees would ask him questions trying to ensnare him in the conversations. And one of the things that this talks about is that they would ask him, they thought, aha, we'll ask a question and see if we can trap him in his speech and make him contradict Moses. And so their motives were certainly insincere. The Sadducees did the same thing. And the story of the Good Samaritan would be an example of that. A lawyer comes and talks to Jesus. What's the first and great commandment? He didn't want to know that. So he's asking a question that is a leading question to get Jesus kind of caught up in something. And so Jesus doesn't answer the question directly, but he tells them a story. And that story is about what we know as the Good Samaritan. And Jesus then ends that story. He doesn't answer the question. He gives a story so the man can answer the question. I call that rolling with resistance. So the man answers his own question. Jesus says, which one of these showed himself to be neighbor? And I'm sure that that lawyer did not really want to answer that question. But he said, well, I suppose the one that helped the guy out. And Jesus told him, go and do thou likewise. So we see how Jesus often with his responses did not give direct answers. But what he would do is give people information that would lead them to come to the right answer by themselves. When I say rolling with resistance, what I'm saying is that when someone is looking for a way to trap you, then what we should do is to look at what is the wise way to answer this question. The Pharisees also came to Jesus, or the Sadducees, and they bring an example of a man that marries a woman and the man dies. And then the brother takes the wife, and then on and on to seven wives. And they say, well, in the resurrection, whose wife will she be? Now, they did not believe in the resurrection. That was a trick question. And there will be those that will try to catch us up and divert into things that take us way off base here. And so Jesus answered the question by correcting the doctrine, that your thought behind the question, you have a fallacy in your thinking, because in the resurrection there's neither married nor given in marriage. And so the question is a moot question as to whose wife will she be. She won't be any of their wives, because in the resurrection there's neither married nor given in marriage. That's how Jesus answered the question. That was not a direct answer, but it was an answer nevertheless. And sometimes people will ask us questions that are loaded questions, or they will make comments that are designed to kind of draw us out and entrap us. And Jesus, basically in his responses, when there was fallacious thinking, what he did is he corrected the fallacy. When there were things that people needed to be able to draw conclusions from, he would ask them a question, as we've just illustrated with the Good Samaritan. We also read how Jesus answered those that strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. That is, they're out here nitpicking. They want to argue about the twist of a word, about they don't like the way we worded something. And there will be people like that. In the book of Proverbs, chapter 29 and verse 11, what we see there is that a fool utters all of his mind. Let me back up. We're told to answer a fool according to his folly, and then almost a contradictory passage says, answer not a fool according to his folly. There in Proverbs 26 and 45. It looks like it's contradictory. What that's talking about is two different kinds of people. If someone's asking you a foolish question, then we may want to respond like that. But then there may be times that we just don't answer the fool, and that we're quiet. For instance, we can go to the one just above that not all questions are sincere. And what we are told there in 2 Timothy 2:23, Paul told Timothy to avoid foolish and unlearned questions because they will gender strife. You see that passage? And so what that means, I hear people say, oh, there is no such thing as a bad question. So if you have a question, raise your hand and ask it. No, that's not how Paul saw it. Some questions are foolish questions. I was in a Bible class. We were studying the book of Jonah, and we were digging down into the book and Jonah's attitude and his need to move on to preach to Nineveh. And one of the brothers raised his hand and said, I have a question. The storm in the story of Jonah, was this storm like a spotlight on the ship, or was it a general storm across the sea? And I don't know the answer. And I don't know that it has anything to do with the story. But for some reason, he thought that was an intelligent question. I didn't. And so what I told him, I said, well, you know, God answered that over in 2 Timothy 2:23. Why don't you turn and read that for us? And he started reading and he turned beet red. Avoid foolish and unlearned questions. And I said, let's move on. Well, he met me at the door afterwards and we had a conversation and several of the brethren just kind of smirked. But sometimes we need to shut things down. We don't need to waste our valuable time in our Bible study with things that are foolish or that have nothing to do with our salvation. There's enough to study to learn the things that are going to get us to heaven without spending time in trivial kinds of questions just because somebody thought it was a smart question. There are such things as foolish questions. He talked about unlearned questions, and he talked about those that would ask things like this, and they wrest the scriptures to their own destruction there in 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 4. Now, in the next place, a fool utters all of his mind. In other words, a fool is known in his multitude of words, the proverb writer said a little earlier. So, a fool is going to empty his mind. Basically, there won't be anything left. And what that says is you don't have to tell people everything you know. That there are some things that you want to hold in reserve, and you want to let your words be choice words that deal with the issues and that bring us to the right conclusions. Now, that's true not only in our worship studies and our Bible studies, but it is also true in our home life, that we don't have to say everything that's on our mind. That's how husbands and wives and families get themselves in trouble, is they open their mouth before they think. And they act on impulse and let things just fly out of their mouth. And often it is some of the most vile, ugly, nasty stuff that could ever come out because it's said in the heat of anger and it is irrational often and it's said without forethought. Our words have the power to heal. They also have the power to destroy. And so if we want healing in our home lives, we need to speak those words that would promote healing. If we want to destroy our family, let's speak words of hate and animosity and malice and bitterness if we want to destroy our family. Well, we got to be careful how we talk and how we respond. And I suggest that we need to look at whether we are acting or whether we are reacting to what's going on in our lives. How do we respond when someone comes at us and they're in attack mode? And we're going to talk about that in this lesson. But I want to suggest that attacking back, climbing the ladder together until we both get to the top and we both are wounded souls, that's not the way the Christian deals with their problems. We are to be sincere and open and ready to hear, be swift to hear and slow to speak, we're told there in Matthew. Now, when we look at dealing with difficult people, 2 Peter 1, 5 through 8 tells us the kinds of things that should be in our speech. For this very reason, make every effort to add to your faith goodness, to goodness knowledge, to knowledge self-control, and to self-control perseverance, and to perseverance godliness, to godliness mutual affection love. Look at this. For if you possess these qualities in increasing measure, they will keep you from being ineffective and unproductive in your knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. He's talking here about the kind of language and the kind of interaction that we have with people. That as Christians, we walk on a higher level, we're in a higher plane, and we do not answer like the world does. We are careful what we say, knowing that we shall give an account. Every word that a man speaks, he will give account thereof in the day of judgment. Now that tells me we need to be very careful. That's not just what you say in a church building. That's what you say when you're on your job. That's what we say to our husbands and wives and to our children and children to their parents and their family members. That's about all of our words, and that we need to be careful. Now, when we speak words that are not what they ought to be, where does that come from? Matthew tells us that, and Jesus speaking, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So when we have vile stuff that comes out, when we get mean and ferocious attitudes that come out, what does that say? That says, I'm ripping my mask off, and I'm going to show you who I really am. I can rip you to shreds. And that is about taking the mask off where we have our pretense, our hypocrisy of here's who you think I am, but you hit me wrong and I'll come at you. Now, that's what that's about. The Christian, whether the mask is on or off, has these attributes in their life. Now, with that in mind, I want to go into some other things. So we've looked at some guiding principles here, and here's another guiding principle, and that is that all people deserve to be treated with respect and dignity. We should never in our language dehumanize another human. And if someone is doing that to you, then one of the best things we can do is say, listen, I care for you too much to let you talk to me that way. And so when we can have a good conversation, let's do that. But for right now, I'm out of here. And so distance yourself. Go somewhere else. Because what will happen if we stay there when someone is treating us with disrespect and they're treating us like we're a piece of trash, that conversation is not going to go anywhere good. And the child of God is going to basically distance himself. There's some conversations we don't need to be in. Those would be times that we need to be silent and then come back to it when we can have a decent conversation. I'll point that out a little later on as well. Now, our approach to a thing sets the tone. And the child of God needs to be careful if we are responding in anger or in malice or in pure emotion. Because when we do that, often our heart is not set on the kind of language God wants us to have. Self-control is one of the pieces of the fruit of the Spirit. And what that says is that we need, as God's children, to be in control of our actions and of our words and of our interactions with each other. The child of God that doesn't do that needs to examine whether they are a faithful child of God or not. I would question that. Now, we're to support one another. We support people, not just behaviors. And what that is about is that sometimes people are having a bad day. And it is not my job in life to give them a worse day. It is my job to walk along beside, to help, to be a healer, to be an encourager. And that's your job too. And it is also our job that when we're having a bad day, to surround ourselves with safe people who can help us to have a better day and to be in control of what's going on in our mind and our heart. You know, not all people are safe people. Evil companions corrupt good morals. You hang out with somebody that's going to pull you down, guess what's going to happen? You're going to get pulled down. And we as Christians need to guard ourselves that we don't surround ourselves with people that are going to be detrimental to our Christianity, or they're going to cause us to act in such a way or encourage us to act in such a way that it causes us to put blemishes on our soul, otherwise known as sin. We need to support and help and encourage one another with our words. Our focus is, in a marriage or anything, is to build healthy relationships. That which edifies. Edify means to build up. And Ephesians, the fourth chapter, the last part of that, talks about speaking those things that edify or that build up one another. The child of God is going to do that. And you know, notice a lot of time we go to chapter 5 when we talk about the home. And there we talk about the husband loving his wife like Christ loved the church and the wife being in subjection. But the thought of that context doesn't start in chapter 5. It actually starts in chapter 4, the end of it. And there he talks about the instead ofs. That the one that stole, let him steal no more. But rather, instead of that, you labor working with your hands to give to those that have not. When we become God's child, what we do is we do the opposite of what we did as the sinner who didn't care about God. And that's demonstrated there in Ephesians 4, 28 through 32. And here's the continuum. You used to steal, and now what you do is you go get a job, and you're a good steward, so you're making money, and what are you doing then? You have to give to those that have not. There's the continuum. That I used to steal, now I give money to people. I used to take from people, now I give it to people. That's the continuum. The Christian life is a life of change, and that's what we see there in the book of Ephesians. A life of change, that we are doing the opposite of what the old man did. That old man died and was buried with Christ, and now we're doing the opposite. And I tell you what, it's going to feel real natural to go back to our old way of life. And often people will excuse that and say, well, that's just the way I am. Well, you need to change the way you are if that's the way you are. And we can do that with Jesus. We can change the way we are. Jesus can change us, change our heart and our lives to where we are not out here being malicious and trying to tear each other up and seeing what we can do to keep each other out of heaven. Our focus is on building a healthy relationship. The next guiding principle is that people are resilient. They can and often do get better through the process of change. How did the sons of thunder become, how did the son of thunder become an apostle of love? Well, when I think of thunder, I think when John and James, when they would talk, it would sound like it was thundering. That tells me something sounded a little violent. But they became, or John did at least, became the apostle of love. You see, when Jesus is in our life and we're doing the right thing, there's a transformation that happens. It doesn't happen overnight, but that transformation happens over time. That's the process of conversion. Conversion is not an event. It is a process. And that is how we grow in that grace and knowledge of Jesus Christ. We don't act like we used to act. When people are caught up in pornography or in other sins, there is a process of change that takes place. And what that means is there is actual evidence in that person's life that they are not the way they used to be, that they are changed. I talk with people just almost every day who are trying to pull out of pornography and betrayal and all kinds of other issues. And what they ask me, the wives often will ask me is, how do I know he's changed? And the answer is, there will be evidence of that change, there will be a remorse that person has, and there will be change in that person's life, and there will be subtle changes, and there will be obvious changes. And when you see those, you can begin feeling that something's changing. He's not the man that he was when we had all of our troubles. He's changed. And if there is no change, there is no change. Well, that's the process of conversion. Let's look at our values. It is quite possible that spiritual values that we have might set us at odds with other people. Jesus said, I came not to send peace but a sword. I came to set father against son and mother against daughter, and your enemies shall be those of your own household. Sometimes, because we stand for truth, and we are people of principle, what that means is our own family may be cut off or estranged from us. Why? Because we are standing on the truth, and that sets us at odds. We must love the Lord above all those things, and that may mean that we're in conflict with our own family. If we learn anything from scriptures, it is that standing for truth and against error is going to bring conflict. Consider the subtle power of spiritual abuse. Now, when I say that, I'm talking about how we talk about domestic violence. We talk about spousal abuse, physical abuse, verbal abuses, and so forth. There's a thing that is called spiritual abuse. And that is when we try to shut down our mate by banging him over the head with the Bible. That here in a discussion, we may be, the wife may be making a point, and the husband comes out and says, "You're not in subjection." Well, if that's the case, we need to deal with that. But that's not what needs to stop an argument. We can take the Bible and beat people over the head and beat them into subjection. That's spiritual abuse. And hold their relationship with God over them so we can win the argument. That's one form of how some people try to deal with issues. Jesus said, and we talked about this, "I came not to bring peace but a sword, to turn a man against his father, daughter against mother, daughter-in-law against mother-in-law, and your enemies shall be those of your own house," Luke chapter 12. Now, some think they're doing God a favor when they take a strong stand, but they may actually be wrong. Brother Roy Cogdell was one of my instructors back in time, and one thing he told several of us that were looking and planning to preach, he said, "Boys, if somebody calls you a liar, don't get mad. Listen to what they said. They just might be right." And I don't think I'll ever forget that. Because if someone were to call me a liar, I'd probably get up in arms. That'd be a first response. That's not always the best response. Examine if people are calling names. Examine, is this something that I need to take a look at? If it is, then take a look at it. If it's not, then put it aside and move on. But some people think that they are doing a favor when they take a strong stand. Saul of Tarsus did that. He thought he was serving God, doing God a favor by persecuting Christians. But he was wrong. And he would have been a difficult person to try to deal with before his conversion. Well, let's look at about repairing spiritual conflicts. The child of God, when we ask the question, "Is it I? Am I the difficult person?" we need to be honest and sincere and willing to change if we are shown to be wrong. Sometimes our first response is to defend ourselves. And that's not always a bad response. But it may be bad if it blocks us from hearing something that we don't want to hear, something that's true. In the New Testament, if the Sadducees and Pharisees were to do that, they blocked the Word of God because they weren't willing to change. Their motives were not pure. I suggest that we need to leave our egos in the parking lot or leave them somewhere else when we come down to discussions. And that has to do with whether it's at home or in a service or whether it's in our work job or our daily discourse, whatever it is. And ultimately, when we're having spiritual conflicts, what we know is God is right. And we need to examine if we have the right attitude, if we have the right information. And if so, then we need to act on that. But examine yourselves, whether you be in the faith, we're told. And that certainly fits in here as well. Well, God is right. There are some people that are difficult to deal with because they always have to be right. If you ever argue with somebody like that, the argument's not over, the discussion's not over until they feel like they are right. And here's what that means. They have to be right, and to do that, you have to be wrong. They're 100% right, and you're 100% wrong. That can happen in the home. It can happen in congregations. And we need to look at that and we need to be willing to acknowledge what's on our side of the street. And is there something I need to look at here instead of just wanting to defend myself that I'm right? And even sometimes people can make up some of the stupidest arguments to justify themselves. And we saw that with Jesus and the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They would come up with stuff that was pretty not very well thought out. And Jesus responded to them. We need to make a resolution. Resolution can be a problem for the one that has to be right. Because one that has to be right is not going to want to lose at any cost. So ultimately what happens, if you have to be right and you're losing the argument, then what happens is the temper comes out, the name calling comes out, and then we shift gears and go to a whole different track, not what's right, but can I bring you down and can I shift the subject to where we're totally off track with what we were even talking about. So the question we need to ask and that need to ask the other person needs to ask is, what part did I play in this? Did I do wrong? There's a man one time that his daughter, his son-in-law, had cheated on his daughter. And she came to mom and daddy and talked with them about it. And the first thing the father asked is, honey, what did you do? And it upset her. She thought he was blaming her. And I don't think he was. But he was just saying, it takes two to be involved in this. What role did you play? And it turned out that she had been defrauding him for years. And he was tempted in a moment, not justified at all, but tempted in a moment. And as soon as it happened, he went and confessed it to her and tried to make amends with her. And she was all upset, and she should have been. But his question was, do you have any ownership in this situation that developed? In other words, were you 100% right and he's 100% wrong? Or was there some shared responsibility in this? And that needs to be asked, I believe. What part do we play in that? Now in Matthew 5 and verse 44, Jesus says, pray for those who despitefully use you. Bless them that curse you. Do good to them that hate you. How many people here like to be cussed out? Anybody? I don't see any hands. All right. We don't like that. Well, what happens when somebody does that? You're riding down the road, somebody flips in on you, or maybe you've clipped them and didn't mean to, and you see them moving their lips and you tell these aren't pleasant words, and they're cursing you. What do you do for them? Do you want to return in kind? Do we speed up and try to cut them off? What do we do? Well, what this tells us to do is to bless those that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for those that despitefully use you. In your home life, do you pray for your mate? Do you pray for your children? Do you pray that God will bless them? I've talked to more than one person that says, I just pray that God will take them where I won't be so miserable. Well, what kind of prayer is that? You're praying for somebody to die. Pray for those that despitefully use you. We could develop that even further, but I'll let that go for tonight. And bless those. Be a blessing to those people that curse you. Don't give them reason to act that way. And we look at techniques of Jesus. We already looked at some of these, so I'm going to zip through this piece relatively quickly. And what we see in Matthew 26:63 is that Jesus sometimes didn't even answer. People ask him a question, and the question was undeserved of an answer. So he didn't answer. It says he held his peace there in Matthew 26:63, there in front of the high priest. He held his peace. No reason to answer. Nothing's going to benefit by answering that question. That's what Jesus did. It says he held his peace. Then we see in Matthew 7:29 that when Jesus spoke, he spoke with authority and not like the Pharisees. So that Jesus wasn't some wimpy person, but when he spoke and he was teaching God's word and he was promoting what was right, he spoke with authority and people listened to him because he spoke with the authority of God. We can do that too, not in the same way. And so he spoke with authority. And sometimes Jesus spoke in stories. Those are we would know as parables, or some of those are stories. He was a man that was characterized by compassion in what he said. You could tell there was sincerity in his message. And he reasoned with them. In other words, he led them to conclusions rather than just pointing his finger and telling them, this is what you got to believe. He also challenged their thinking, and he was very directive in the way he handled people, and he often led them to conclusions like, who is my neighbor? Or the story of the prodigal son. And he led them to conclusions. You know, the story of the prodigal son is really not about the prodigal son. It's about the prodigal son's brother. If you read the first part of that chapter, Luke chapter 15, what you'll see is that was addressed to the Pharisees who considered themselves to be righteous and put others at naught. It was to the Pharisees who thought they were better than everybody else. Well, that's another story. But Jesus led them to the conclusion. Sometimes Jesus used strong language. He told the Pharisees after 3 years of dealing with them, he called them white as sepulchers, told them they were full of dead men's bones, and called them a generation of vipers. Who warned you to flee from the wrath to come? Well, there is a time for strong language. But I want to suggest that's not the start of Jesus' ministry. That's after time after time after time dealing with these people, and they've shown their true colors. That's when it was a time for that, for the strong language. As much as lies in you, be at peace with all men. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Now the question is, Lord, is it I? And as we said before, we need to examine ourselves and our role in all interactions and ask the question, am I coming across right? Am I using language and am I behaving in such a way that it will bring glory and honor to the Lord? In 1 Timothy 5:2, lay hands hastily on no man, and neither be partaker in other men's sins. I understand that to mean don't be quick to endorse people. Just because they come across acting like they're good people doesn't mean that you just automatically are gullible. But instead, we need to watch what kind of person is it. And you ever notice in life that sometimes the people that come on too quickly and that want to be your friend too quickly, sometimes those are the ones you better watch for. Not all of them, but we do need to be aware that sometimes people will move in very quickly and they can turn just like a pendulum goes one way, it'll go the other way too. Watch. Lay hands hastily on no man, and he says, neither be partaker of other men's sins. In other words, don't get caught up in what other people are doing. Thou shalt not go with a multitude to do evil, the Old Testament tells us in the book of Proverbs. Well, here's some forms of conflict, or here's some things about how personalities are formed. Now, I'm going to move kind of into some more technical stuff here, because this has to do with what's going on with the people we just talked about in these verses. So the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the personality types that were there, and I want to talk about that for just a moment and use a couple of examples of different personalities. There is a role in people's life that all of us have different temperaments. A temperament is something you're born with. That is that some babies are very quiet, very nice baby. And if you were a bad kid, you don't deserve that kind of kid. But you might get one like that. Then there are some kids that from the moment they're born, they are wailing and crying, and they're just kind of like, we think we've had a demon child. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Okay, ever have a child like that? Well, temperament plays a part. How we respond, how we react to things, that's temperament. Now, temperament is kind of fixed. That would be some traits that are there. Doesn't mean we have to act that way, but it means that would be a natural way, the way we're wired. That's how we respond to life and to various stimulus situations. Can that be altered and can it be controlled? The answer is absolutely yes. So family, our environment has to do with how we deal with things. Our attitudes, our biases, how we deal with people that look different than we do, or how we deal with genders. Those things are learned in our environment. They're not learned naturally. They're learned by the environment and by our upbringing, by our culture, if you would. and that impacts how we treat people. Fact is, all cultures have their biases toward other cultures. I was surprised to find out that I smell like a wet dog. That's what I was told. I was in a cultural diversity class, and one of the strangest exercises I ever had to do was all the different types went into groups. All the white guys went in one group. All the black people went in another group. And brown and red bone, different cultures within cultures. The Indian people, Native American people, they went another one. And guess what our assignment was? We want you to write down everything you've heard about these other folks in these other groups. Well, I was pretty uncomfortable with that. And I was even more uncomfortable when we had to select someone to read that stuff. But we've all heard that. That's the biases of our culture. You know, there's some people you can't trust. Well, you let them alone, they might take your stuff. Or be careful, down the street corner, they might try to jump in the car with you. There's biases of all sorts that are out there. Some of those we need to certainly exercise caution and safety, but there's a lot of biases. There's good people in all cultures. But sometimes what we do is because we have our cultural stereotypes that we may react to different people. It may be that we don't see them as leaders. We see them as subordinate because we have a supremacy to our particular culture. And we need to be aware of that if that's going on with us. The Bible tells us, and it doesn't specify what culture you're in, but we're to esteem others better than ourselves. And that doesn't say if you're white or if you're black or if you're Native American, then you esteem others better. It just says if you're a Christian, that's what you do. Esteem others better than yourself. Well, that can be a little difficult in a culture that teaches us maybe indirectly that that's not the way it is. Sometimes we think of people that are from different socioeconomic settings. And when we deal with them, we may form biases. I dealt with homeless people for about 8 years. My job was to take homeless people off the streets of Indianapolis and to provide them with housing and with a program that would help them get back on their feet. And we did that. It was a 2-year program. And we did that. And our success rate was 92% of those people became successful. Well, the point was, when I started in on that, I was asked to write down my biases about people that are homeless. And I have to tell you, I was ashamed of what I wrote down. And what it turned out is that it wasn't true. I even asked some of the formerly homeless people, would you look this over and tell me if this is true of the people who are homeless? And what often they would look at, they would say, well, you know, about 92% of the time it's not true. But about 8% of the time it is, and that 8% make the rest of us look bad. Are all homeless people out to steal from you? Out to dupe you? No. Are some? Yeah. Some that are in other parts of the culture, they're also out to do the same thing. And so we need to be careful not to generalize and stereotype people. That can create all kinds of issue, and not to treat them as if they are less than the rest of us. Personalities can also drive conflict. And personality is that not only temperament, but personality can drive conflict where we just don't like the way someone acts. They're too passive or they're too assertive, and so we don't like the way they act. Or they look a certain way and remind us of somebody that we've had conflict with, so we treat them like they're that person. That's called projection and transference. And we got to be really careful of that. I ran into that when I was working in a veterans program, and there was a doctor there that looked just exactly like someone that had been not on my good list. Had been a bully to me in life. And I have to admit that I had trouble working with that doctor. And it wasn't because he'd done anything wrong. It's because when I looked at him, I wasn't seeing him. I was seeing someone that had mistreated me in the earlier part of my life. That was a bias. And I'm thankful I got to work with him and ended up doing some marriage counseling with him and his wife, and got their families together. But that was a real challenge to me, to have to override that which was coming up in me at first, to override that and see this person not as another person, but to see this person for who they are. Do you ever have time like that? That somebody reminds you of somebody, and it's kind of easy to do that transference. Nobody's shaking their head, so I guess I'm the only one. There's one or two, okay. All right, but personality can drive our conflict. Personality is deeply ingrained in us, the way we act, our approach to life, and typically that develops early in our adolescence. Our styles are going to affect our thoughts, our emotions, our interpersonal functioning, and ultimately our impulse control. And then genetics play also a part in this as to our body and what our physical size is, whether we are some big old person or whether we're some little person or we're skinny or whatever the deal is, our genetics play a part in that and how we perceive other people in relationship to us. And our communication is going to come through filters. The female, for instance, is going to filter through her age, through her experience in life, through her gender, and how she's been treated, any traumas that might be there. Everything that comes into that person's thought are going to be filtered in that way. Same with a male. We filter it through our life experience too. That's where conflict often comes from in people's lives. All right. Our early experiences in life certainly impact us and can create in us some issues that maybe aren't healthy, such thing as we lost parents early in our life, or we may have had a mom and dad that weren't like everybody else's mom and dad. Maybe they were mean people, maybe they were drug addicts, or maybe they did some awful things to us or involving us. The stories are just resplendent of childhood traumas. I'll spare you those tonight. But physical abuse takes place in a lot of homes, and people that we little think they have trouble in life behind closed doors, their world is a whole different world than it is when they have their mask on and they're all around us. We have to be careful with that. And by the way, we need to be careful how we touch each other. Some people are huggy people, and some people are kind of like to touch and all that stuff. Be careful. Ask permission to touch, and here's why. 25% of females are sexually abused by the time they're 18 years old. You look at this population in here, I hope that would be a different number here, but my guess is it may not be a whole lot different. And 20% of males have been sexually abused by the time they're 18 years old. Now, with that in mind, we need to be careful because a touch, while it may just be a sign that we're just trying to get their attention, it may mean something very different to the other person. Don't assume it's okay to hug people. Ask them. When you shake hands with people, there's some people don't want to shake hands with you because they touch means something different to them. But that all has to do with not people being rude, but with a different interpretation of what physical touch can mean in that person's life. There's some people that will cringe if you reach out to touch them. And so we need to be careful of that. Various traumas and certainly wartime experiences can play a big part in that. All right. In a diagnostic manual, there are different personalities that are listed, and they list them as cluster A, B, and C. Isn't that ingenious? All right. Cluster A is really about more of the psychoses, and cluster B is more the kind of people that we normally interact with. And I want to talk about those. Cluster A is generally uncomfortable in interpersonal situations. They are people who are emotionally distant. Basically, they don't want a lot to do with you. They're kind of standoffish, and they're difficult to engage in conversation, and they may be very isolative, unlikely to tolerate intense or ongoing conflicts. So when there's conflict, they're going to tend to back off or just kind of avoid that, even though they might be right. They don't want to engage in conflict. Okay, this cluster is cluster B, though, is the one that is the most challenging. Cluster B is going, these are people that will likely push your boundaries. And what boundary means is when there's a rule set, they want to test that rule to see, can they put their big toe over the line? And so they'll push the boundaries. Cluster B also can be interpersonally inappropriate. In other words, that they're not only do they push boundaries, but they challenge whether they have to follow the norms. Why? Because Cluster B is special. Cluster B is the people that think that they are not like everybody else. They're privileged. Okay. Well, so they may be interpersonally inappropriate. Often they are attention-seeking, and they're demanding and manipulative and emotionally unstable. Now, what does that look like when we get people like that in congregation? What that means is these are the people that are wanting the attention, and these are people that will get attention almost at any cost. They want you to recognize them. They want to be special. They want to stand out. They want you to treat them differently because they're not like everybody else, at least in their own mind. Okay? And we'll talk about how to deal with these in just a minute. All right? Cluster B also, as we said, these people seek to be the center of attention. And I want to give a couple of examples of this group. There are about seven categories in this, but the two most obvious are the histrionic and the narcissistic. And I'm going to spend a piece of our time on them. If you think of Miss Piggy, everybody knows who Miss Piggy is? Moi? Theatrical? Drama queen? That's histrionic. You know anybody like that? And the narcissistic is the one that's in love with himself. They're the one that any conversation you have, they may ask you, how'd your day go? And you tell them, my day went, and they automatically shift the subject to themselves. It's all about them. These are the ones that will often gaslight. And what that means is they want to win by making you feel like you're crazy, helping you feel foolish. These are the ones that if we use the empty cup theory and we have two cups that are half full of water or some liquid, and that would symbolize equality in a relationship. It's 50-50 or 60-40, but somewhere in there. But the narcissist isn't happy until all the water in their cup or your cup is in their cup. What that means is it's 100% about me and it's nothing about you because you are nothing. That's the narcissist. Now, in a relationship, that won't work. People that are in relationships like that find themselves constantly put down. And ultimately, you're going to feel like that they are in such despair that they don't know what to do. And in the church, sometimes marriage can look like a prison, that they're trapped in the marriage with a person that is demeaning and is abusive and is just constantly putting them down, that they are nothing. We'll talk about that in a minute, some more. All right. The narcissist and the histrionic are self-focused. It's all about me. I'm the drama queen. I'm the person that everybody needs to play to because, hey, I'm special. So you need to treat me like a person that's special. And that means you have to be subservient to me. They lack empathy. They don't care what's going on with you. It's all about them. And there are some characteristics they have. They get drawn into intense ongoing conflicts. In other words, they'll pick a fight. Here's how that works in a home where we've got infidelity going on. Let's say the guy is the narcissist, and he comes in the door at the end of the day, and here's the wife there at home, and he comes in and he starts a fuss. Now, it doesn't matter what the fuss is about. The motive for the fuss is not fussing. The motive for the fuss is I need an excuse to get out of the house tonight because I got something else going. That's your narcissist. And what he'll make the wife think sometimes is, well, you know, you make it so uncomfortable here that I've got to step out. Well, guess what? When I get mad, act like I'm mad, leave in a huff, I don't have to tell you where I'm going or when I'm coming home or if I'm coming home. And so now I've cut myself free for the evening and I gaslighted you, I played you, and I can go do what I want to do. Have I described anything anybody knows or can relate to? Characteristics that draw them into intense conflict where we're arguing most of the time and I'm always right. Now, if you're trying to help people like this, let's look at some things you can do. I suggest, as the proverb writer said, that the first one with a response appears to be right. So when these people come to us and they say, we're having trouble and I need some insight, or I've just had all I can take, here's what's going on, and I need some help. When they come to us, the first one that comes to us looks like they're right. And if we're not careful, we get drawn up in that, and we say, well, let's go get some stones and go stone them. Anybody treat you that way? But there's usually more to the story. And so we need to find out what's the other piece of the story. And then we need to see somewhere between all that, where's the truth? So that passage about lay hands suddenly on no man, certainly it can apply here, is be careful. Just because someone is hurting and comes to you doesn't mean they're right. It simply means that they're hurting so bad they had to ask for outside help, and we need to give them that help, but we need to be honest with them and not just immediately jump in and take their side. Try to be, if you're asked to be an arbitrator or a coach in this, try to listen to both sides of the thing and then come up with a wise conclusion as to who or what is right. So maintain healthy skepticism. Avoid being swayed by someone's charm. A narcissist, by the way, does anybody remember the days of Remington Steele? Pierce Brosnan? Some of you do. All right. Or Brett Maverick? I'm aging myself, aren't I, terribly? All right. But they were narcissists. They were the people that come in and sway a room, charming, have anybody they want, wrap them around their finger. That's the narcissist. They played their roles well. Avoid being swayed by the charm. Now, that is difficult even for law enforcement and even lawyers and courts of law, because these people are extremely well at being charming. But beware. That charm is something on the surface. And if the charm doesn't work, they can be just as vile as they can be charming. And so they can turn and rip you up. Be careful. And so if we're talking with people like this, sometimes it's best to have at least a witness when they come and tell us what's going on. Most of the time, these are guys, but not always. And so the narcissist is a difficult person to deal with. Avoid being swayed by them. They may ask you for favors, trying to get you on their side. Okay? And they may throw themselves at your, can you help me? Jeff, we got this stuff going on. I don't know what to do. Can you just help us? And Jeff, I hope you don't jump up and say, well, of course, I'll go fix it for you. Let me rescue you. That's what they want. And if you do that, guess what? When you inject yourself into the problem, you become part of the problem. No. You need to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. Don't complicate it by getting yourself in there and don't work harder on their problem than they do. I ask the question to people often, who owns this problem? Whose problem is it? I'm asked sometimes, Art, how can you talk to people as much as you do all day and you hear all these stories and some of them are just horrible and sad stories? How can you do that all the time? And the answer is, their problem is not my problem. I am part of the solution. I am the coach. I am the advisor. I'm the consultant. But I'm not part of the problem. When I become part of the problem, then I'm not going to be able to help very well the solution. That's where therapists and people that are in any kind of advisory positions get themselves in trouble. That's how folks get into affairs, is when they lose their objectivity in dealing with that person and they begin to let their emotions get involved and they give more attention to that person than is due, and they actually try to rescue that person from themselves. That's not our role. Not our role. There's been more than one person that has entered these gates trying to help someone and has been pulled down to the ground, reputations ruined, sometimes marriages ruined, sometimes their preaching and leadership roles are challenged, and sometimes these things get into the legal end, and people have all kinds of ramifications. Be careful when you're dealing with people that try to get you to be a part of the problem. Well, obtain cooperative information or collateral information. Explain to these people the consequences of future misconduct if they keep on with this. Be prepared to impose and to enforce consequences with these people. And then pay attention to your fears and be sure that you're in a setting where you can defend yourself. A rule of principle that I use is don't do anything that if a newspaper reporter were here, that you'd be ashamed to have it reported in the paper tomorrow. That's a pretty good rule, I think. Pay attention to your fears and to your gut feelings and maintain a clear boundary. All right, so those are the examples of the histrionic. There's other pieces on here. These things you can feel free to use these however you choose to. These PowerPoints are yours. Our time is up for tonight. And so what I want to do is leave this discussion by simply saying there are difficult people and not everybody is going to be able to be the smiley, nice people that they present themselves to be. Behind the smile can be a lot of things that aren't there. If you're a young person, let me talk to you just a moment. Be careful who you choose for friends. Sometimes what people want to do is to use you because you may be a popular person, you may be somebody that has something they want, or there's some benefit to them. Be careful who you allow in your life, because these people, while you can find some very good friends out there, you want to be selective as to who are your friends. There's a difference in a friend and an acquaintance. And remember that evil companions will corrupt your good morals. And that's always been true. Many people tried to disprove that and they've all lost. Evil companions corrupt good morals. Stay innocent. Don't let other people rob you of your innocence. You'll always be happy about that. But it won't always feel like the right thing to do in the moment. Be careful. And those of us who are a little older, let's be careful who we associate with. There are some folks that we're thrown together with simply by circumstance. Maybe we both work the same job or something's going on that we have to interact. We don't have to like what they do. Righteous Lot didn't like the homosexuals he was around. He grieved his righteous soul, but he had to interact with them for some reason. Be careful. Evil companions will corrupt good morals. That's one of the reasons that Christians need to stay in fellowship with other Christians. We need the support and the strength. When we're weak, we need to draw on each other's strength. When we're strong, other people need to draw on our strength. That's called fellowship, and that's the way it ought to be. Well, we're all going to run into different types of people, and there's much more we could say on this subject, but I'm going to leave that for tonight, because the subject of difficult people is not going to go away. Study your Bible, some of the verses we used in the very beginning. How did Jesus deal with people that are like the ones that you find in your life? And then ask the question, do I really need those kind of people in my life, or do I need to basically distance myself? In addiction recovery, what we talk about is, in order to get better, there's something you need to do. And that is, you need to change your people, places, and things. People's first. You need to watch who you're hanging around with. My daughters used to come home laughing funny. And I wonder, what's going on with them? I didn't know the way they laugh. And what I took note is that they had spent time with a new friend. And they develop a new laugh. Anybody else have kids like that? That laughter was something they were learning from their friends. Well, anything wrong with it? It's just different for them. But we are creatures socializing, or as we socialize, we are creatures of imitation. And we imitate the people that we're around. Be careful who you're around. That's who you'll imitate in your life, in your language, in our attitudes. And I think finally of the passage that says, and they took note that they had been with Jesus. When you walk with Jesus, guess what? You're going to act like Him. So walk with Him. Let Him be your guiding force. And let Him make the changes in your life. That's our lesson for tonight. A lot of information that I hope is helpful to you, as we've covered a lot of material. But I leave this with you, and I just ask, if there's someone here tonight that needs to leave something behind in their life, to leave maybe the choices that you've made, and to make a choice tonight to live for Jesus, to surrender all the way to Him, to put aside the things that will hurt you. That's all the Lord asks of you, is to give up what will hurt you. And sin will hurt you. Bad friends will hurt you. Bad attitudes will hurt you. Bad language will hurt you. Leave all that behind. If we can help you to be right with the Lord, to get your attitude right and to walk on the straight and narrow, to cleanse yourself so that you can have the right kind of disposition and not be a difficult person, if we can help you with that, I invite you to come to the front. Let's stand and sing this song to encourage you.